Okay, hi, and welcome to another episode of the Leadership Enigma. And now we are the other side of 200 episodes. Could you believe that? My guest at the moment is looking quite surprised on the screen. But this is going to be a wonderful episode because let's ask quite a big question, actually. What is life all about? And I'm always exploring on this show the human being over the human doing. And I've got an amazing guest, Laurie Drowdy, who is an author, a keynote speaker, a coach. But she's known for something else because she had a call sign. Her call sign was Rowdy. And if you've watched Top Gun like me and you're thinking of the call sign Maverick, that's because my guest, Laurie, was actually one of the first female combat pilots in the US Navy, with 300 carrier landings and two assignments to the Persian Gulf. I think we have a lot to talk about. Come back to me just after the break. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to the Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Laurie, it's absolutely wonderful to see you. That was my attempt at giving a little bit of an intrigue to the introduction. I'm not sure how I did, but you tell me. How are you?
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Thank you, Adam. I'm doing great. And I'm just so excited to be here and talk with you today.
It is great to talk to you. Where are you in the world? Just help everyone with that.
Yes. Right now I am in Tampa, Florida. I am I'm living with my parents for just a couple months here before I move up to Boston. So I'm in Florida and surviving the heat.
Well, I can say that we've got a little bit of heat here in London, but I'm very, very fond of Boston. So I've got some ties to Boston too. So I'm going to be in Boston actually later in the year, nearer Christmas time. On a project.
Excellent.
So maybe we can meet up for coffee in the Boston area. So there we go.
Perfect.
I gave a bit of an introduction, but just tell everyone a little bit about what you're doing now, and then we'll go back to what you did do. But what are you doing now, Laurie?
Yeah. So right now I am a professional speaker and an executive coach, and I talk with audiences about how it's actually very aligned with your podcast, Adam, which is we focus a lot on the human doing, and we really need to focus more on the human being, about how we want to be in the world versus getting too caught up in what we're doing. And it's not to say that what we're doing isn't important, but it's about how do we align what matters most to us to ensure, align that with what we are actually doing in our lives to ensure that we're living a life that we love. And that's why I actually titled my second book, A Combat Pilot's Wisdom on Living a Life You Love, because we have one go around on this planet, as far as we know, unless you believe in reincarnation. And so I think it's really important for us to learn how to mitigate fear, because I think fear is typically what holds us back, right, from doing the things that we really want to do. And once we can, you know, make a friend out of fear and recognize it and get along with it, then we can decide how we want to spend our time here. So that's the message I've been sharing with my audiences and with my coaching clients as well, supporting them to ensure they're doing the things in the world that they want to do the most. But I've always been fascinated with leadership and service. Those are, you know, two of my values. So I'm about to start a one-year fellowship at Harvard University that is an advanced leadership initiative fellowship, where I'll be exploring how I want to show up in the world as a leader and what I might want to do next.
Okay.
Because I love speaking and I love coaching, but I miss working with a team. And so I'm thinking about looking at what kind of team do I want to be a part of moving forward?
Okay. Well, you've certainly come to the right place, and already you've piqued my curiosity. Why has that? I know why I ended up in this place, but why have you ended up in this place of curiosity around the human being over the human doing? Because you've done some incredible things, and you've also done some incredibly difficult things, which I'll come on to. Why have you landed here? Sorry, no pun intended either.
I landed here at the correct angle of attack. No, I just feel like it's been an evolution for sure. I think, you know, as a child or even growing up, I very much absorbed the messages of, you know, what you do is most important. Like, you know, work really hard and things will be successful. Or, you know, you have to go to a particular school if you want to be successful, or you have to do a particular thing. And what I found, even though I've been very fortunate, I have done some things that, you know, or I have had achievements that feel like, oh, wow, you know, they're wonderful. It's more about how was I during those things? Because I think that, you know, if I go to an amazing school that has a brand name, but I, you know, completely waste away my time there, that's not really success. And it's not really something that's going to lead to a better world or a better person for me. It's not going to help with my own development. So I think it's recognizing that no matter where we are and, you know, whatever situation we're in, we get to choose what we want to make of that. So I think that, you know, how did I land here? I think it's just been life, you know, like I'm in my 50s. So I'm lucky that I've had a lot of life experiences.
The best place to be, Laurie.
Yeah, isn't it? It's awesome. So, I feel like just having had these life experiences and also having had the privilege of working all over the world and seeing so many different cultures and how people are with each other, it just really brought home the point to me that, you know, we are all human beings. And yes, we exist in different environments with different upbringings and different situations, but we do have that one thing in common. And so I think that's what's really piqued my curiosity about how can we, you know, hopefully work together better? How can we show up better in the world? And that's really where what's brought me to this place where I'm just so much more curious about people and how we work together.
Okay. And you also mentioned the word service. And, you know, I took a period of time out. I did a lot of work with the criminal justice sector and with law enforcement. So there was an element of service within me. But let's go then to what people are probably very curious about, because it was probably quite an extreme environment for a decade for you, which maybe will give us a little bit of some clues as relation to where you are now and some of the learning that you have. So you were one of the first female combat pilots for the US Navy, correct? Yeah.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what that means. What were you actually doing that put you into that category?
Absolutely. When I went to college, I really was not sure what I wanted to do in life, let alone right after college. But I grew up in a Marine Corps family. So my father was a career Marine Corps infantry officer.
Right.
He retired as a general. My mother even served in the Marine Corps for a year. But back in the late 60s.
So you never stood a chance, Laurie, let's be honest, in relation to
that. I did, right. It's genetic, essentially. Like, I had to go into the military. And actually, you know, there was certainly strong family support for doing so. And really to the point of expectation that to some degree we would serve our country. And so in college, I had signed up for Navy ROTC, and I didn't get a 4-year scholarship coming out of high school, but they had a program where if you just joined the unit and you did really well your freshman year, you would get a scholarship. And I was fortunate that that's what happened to me.
Right.
But my freshman year of college, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I was majoring in, I think, political science. And I went on a field trip that literally changed my life, because we visited several naval air stations and Marine Corps air stations in Southern California. And it was the first time I had ever been exposed to aviation. You remember, my father was an infantry officer.
Yeah,
so
very different.
Really, you're right. We weren't around airplanes. And it was the first time I had any idea that that might be something I could do in the military. And when I talked with the pilots there, they said that, you know, women weren't allowed to fly pretty much any of the airplanes we were looking at. They were all, you know, tactical combat jets and helicopters. However, they knew that there were some women flying in the military, and they were serving as either instructor pilots, so they would teach people how to fly, or they were serving as support pilots.
Right.
So they would fly and teach fighter pilots how to do their missions. So I thought, wow, that sounds interesting and challenging. And I always loved a good challenge. I always love, trying new things. And so when I got back to school, one of my friends had his private pilot's license. So he took me up for a flight in a Cessna and I absolutely loved it. It was amazing. And I was nervous I was going to get sick, air sick, and I didn't. And I found it fascinating just to see the world from that different perspective. So that's when, the switch flipped and I said, this is what I want to do. And then that summer, Top Gun, the first Top Gun movie came out. And so everyone was just like,
Timing is
everyone
everything.
wants to be Maverick. Yeah. So that's really what brought me into it. And so when I graduated from college and went to flight school, I was expecting that I would be either an instructor pilot or a support pilot. And I was fine with that. I was like, hey, I just want to support our country and serve in whatever way I can.
Right.
But I do remember when we, even as a support pilot, part of the winging process of getting your wings and finishing your flight training is landing on the aircraft carrier. So even if you're going to a land-based squad, a jet squadron, you still have to land a jet on a carrier. And I remember sitting there, after I had landed, of course, just like terrified and thrilled. I remember looking out, while I was getting refueled. So I had a couple moments where I could sit there and just kind of watch everything that was going on. And I just thought, this is incredible. Like just seeing everyone doing their job and working so well as a team. And it was this incredible, ballet almost of people just doing what they needed to, being where they needed to, and just all the stuff that was happening on the aircraft carrier and, looking out at the ocean. And it was just like, that was one moment where I was like, gosh, this actually really would be super
It's pretty cool,
amazing
right?
to be a part of this. And so I was a little sad knowing that, well, yeah, okay, I can't do this, but I can serve in a support capacity. And then, surprise, like a year and a half after I got my wings, the ban on women flying in combat was lifted.
What was
And
just
I,
forgive me for
yes.
interrupting. What was behind the ban in the first place?
I think it was just history.
Right.
It was the evolution of the military and who is allowed to do what. And I mean, if you look at the history of women serving in the military,
Yeah.
and women have served since the Revolutionary War. I mean, not always openly or as women, many women dressed as men so that they could serve in the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. Every single time there's been a conflict or a war, women have participated and their participation grew over time. So, in World War II, you had women who were serving in like auxiliary forces of the armed services. And eventually then they became official members of the military. And in the 70s, their roles expanded. In the early 70s, women were allowed to fly. So we had, the first female pilots, but again, they were restricted to non-combat
Yeah.
roles. So I think time was happening, and the roles of women just in society in America were expanding as well. And, 100 years ago, women weren't doctors or lawyers, but now, those roles were expanding. And I think the perception of what women were capable of doing was expanding as well.
Okay.
But there were a couple of things that I think were, the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. It was Tailhook 91, which was a convention for naval aviators where
Right.
there were many women and some men who had been assaulted at the convention, and that brought a lot of attention to how the Navy in particular was treating women and how they perceived women. But even before Tailhook, you go back to the first Gulf War, and even though women were not technically in combat squadrons or combat roles, they were getting shot at. And there were women who were taken as prisoners of war, and there were women who were killed.
Right.
And previously, the thought was, oh, we can't. That can't happen. America will freak out if women are shot in battle.
Right.
And instead, it was very much respected. Like, hey, if a woman is willing to give her life for our country, we should respect that and allow her to serve in a way that leverages her skills and her abilities. And so I think all those things were kind of
You
coming
were
into
part of the
play. And there was also,
evolution, Laurie,
yeah,
weren't you?
I was, yeah, just, I mean, completely, I was not one of these kids who, went to an air show when I was five and was like, I want to be a Blue Angel. I really kind of fell into it, but it aligned so much with what was important to me, which was service and leadership. And also, being able to have people who are good at doing something, make sure that they're in roles where they can do that. And, we had this whole group of people, women, who had skills that would enable them to be good pilots. And so
So
I think all those things came together, and
right.
that's what contributed to the lifting of the ban.
So when you joined the US Navy, you thought you would just be flying and maybe teaching, instructing, but not flying combat jets. But something changed, didn't it? Tell us what changed and what that led to for you.
Yeah, I think, when there was movement around lifting the ban, I recognized, oh, wow, I might be part of this first wave of women going through and flying in combat squadrons. And I think for me, mostly I was, grateful. I felt like, okay, if this is an opportunity that's opening up to me and I feel like I'm qualified to do it, then yes, hell yes, I want to do it. And I mean, I'd gone through flight school with all these men. I was the only female student in my class and actually on the base for most of the time I was there. And so I knew that I was just as good of a pilot as they were, better than some, not as good as others. I was, actually my first book is called She's Just Another Navy Pilot because I wanted to reinforce that, the Navy has pretty high standards for pilots. And
I
if you
bet.
meet those standards, you are a pilot. And so, yes, I when the ban was lifted, I absolutely raised my hand and I was, really, I wanted to be part of that first wave in particular because I wanted to be able to support, not just the whole notion of women flying in combat squadrons, but I really wanted to support the female sailors. And I wanted to be able to, to be a role model for them, but also to be an
Right.
advocate for them, and to make sure that, someone was out there who could empathize with a lot of the things they were going through being part of this. And I just felt also I had always had a really good rapport with my male squadron mates. And I think because of my military upbringing, maybe because I have two brothers, I just always felt very comfortable working with men. And so I wanted to make sure I was part of that first deployment because I felt like I could help make it successful,
Right.
or do whatever I could in my role. I wasn't a senior leader, I was a junior officer, but still I felt, I want to do whatever I can to help support this effort.
And so you were part of that first wave
Yes.
of female naval combat pilots. So what did you end up flying that you never thought you would be allowed to fly?
Oh, well, I mean, before the ban was lifted, I flew the FA-18 Hornet in a support squadron.
Right.
So I was not flying the Hornet in order to go like fight with it. I was flying the Hornet to train other fighter pilots how to shoot down missiles. So basically, it was a really fun job. I flew the Hornet really fast and pretended to be a missile. And
Right.
so they would practice tracking me and then pretend to shoot me down. And so
That's fun.
that
Are you
it
sure?
was
Are you
fun.
sure that's fun now, Laurie?
I get to fly an F-18 Hornet. So that's actually what I was doing before the ban was lifted. And
Right.
then when the ban was lifted, I transitioned to a jet. It's no longer in the Navy inventory, but it's the S-3B Viking. It's an anti-submarine warfare jet. It's carrier based and it carries four people. So, I was used to flying by myself or with maybe a backseater, a naval flight officer who would, control the radios and the weapons and communication. But in the S-3B, it was different. Like, and actually, I really liked it because I was part of a crew. And
Right, the
so I
team.
was working. Right, exactly. And so I got to work with, naval flight officers, and air crewmen. So we actually would have an enlisted air crewman flying with us, and they were in charge of sonobuoys. So because it was an anti-submarine warfare jet, we would search out and engage with enemy submarines. That was our mission. And so I really enjoyed having to have that teamwork. And also, I felt that responsibility of making sure You know, it wasn't just me landing on the aircraft carrier. I had a crew to take care of and to bring home safely. So I really enjoyed that. Like there were some really difficult nights mostly, as far as landings go. But I really enjoyed working with the team.
I can only imagine what it's like to land a jet on a moving aircraft carrier in the middle of the sea, and you did that something like 300 times. Just
And
explain.
99 of those times were at 99 of those times were at night.
So
So
99 of those times were at night. I mean, just try to help us understand what on earth is that like? Because we're talking about an experience now that very few people have ever had.
yes. It's funny because you train for it extensively before you ever go out and see an aircraft carrier. So, during my flight training, I was doing simulators. I was flying the simulator, going out and landing in the aircraft carrier. I was doing practice landings at the airfield. I mean, literally hundreds of landings to practice to get ready
Right.
to go out. But I mean, everyone remembers their first time landing on the aircraft carrier because there's just this mix of emotions. Like, you're so thrilled that you finally get to go out and do this thing you've been preparing for a while. You're also like, I mean, there's terror for sure because you're looking down at this little thing and you're like, I cannot believe I'm doing this. Like, this is insane. Like, whoever came up with this idea in the first place? But then you're also fascinated because it's like, wow, this is amazing that all this works. And so yeah, it was thrilling. It was absolutely thrilling the first time. It's also funny because you get all this training and so you feel like you're ready. I felt like I was pretty ready when I went out to the ship. And then as soon as you see the meatball, which is our lighting indicator to
Right.
land, I mean, I just, everyone, I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing, but somehow I managed to land.
99 times.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, we only do daytime carrier qualifications during our flight training before we get our wings. But then once you report to your fleet squadron, which is the squadron that you're going to actually deploy on an aircraft carrier for 6 months or more, then you do night carrier landings. And then it's like, oh, okay, this just got real.
Right.
And daytime's fun. I mean, daytime got to the point where it was just a blast. And I loved the daytime landings, but nighttime where you that's where you definitely earn a
Comfortably un
paycheck.
uncomfortable. I've
Yeah.
got to ask you the question. I know you're staying with your parents at the moment. How did your parents, who are
Yeah.
both Marines, former Marines, feel about their daughter joining the Navy?
My father was thrilled. Oh, joining the Navy? Yes. I mean, they were very supportive because, when I was in Navy ROTC, women were not allowed to fly in the Marine Corps at all.
Right.
So if I wanted to be an aviator, I could only do that in the Navy or
Oh,
the Air
okay.
Force or the Army or Coast Guard. But because all of the Marine aviation roles, I think at that time were almost all combat aviation, that wasn't even an option for me. So I never considered becoming a Marine officer. So they were very happy that I was going into the Navy. My dad is a Naval Academy graduate, so I
Okay.
think, yeah, they were very proud. It's funny though because now, I'm a mom and my kids are in their early 20s now. But I get it. Like, my son loves riding motorcycles and I'm just like, ah. But then I can't really, tell him not to because, as he's reminded me, hey, mom, remember what you were doing when you were 22? It wasn't exactly the safest thing. So,
Yeah, you haven't
I
quite
have a
got a leg to
greater
stand on,
appreciation
have you?
now. Yes,
Yeah.
I really appreciate what they went through now.
Listen, we talked about, I mean, there's a huge fun aspect to it and an enormous amount of work that's gone into it. But when we first chatted, do you remember, I said to you, let's talk about what the ultimate role might be as well. Because I said to
Yes.
you, how did you, or help people understand, how do you prepare yourself to potentially take the life of another human being?
Yeah.
How do you think about that? Because every time you go on deployment, real deployment, that could
Yeah.
be an ask of you, couldn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, that's it's not all the military is about, but that is absolutely the expectation is that if you have to, or if you are called to do a mission. And I mean, that's, there are plenty of aviators who have done this. I was fortunate that I never had to. I think I'm fortunate I never had to. But there is an expectation that you are going to have to kill another human being. And I think for aviators, at least when I was flying, the technology wasn't as advanced as it is now.
Right.
There was still a fair separation between you and your target. And so, it wasn't as direct as, ground combat, for
Yeah,
example.
infantry.
Obviously that's very, very direct. But yes, I think, for me, it was looking at thinking about the big picture and having trust in my leadership that they're only going to ask us to do that if there's really no other way to resolve a situation or to find peace in a situation. And I think that, I think also being younger, being in my 20s, really, when I was in those situations, I think it was more easily accepted, for me at that time. But it also, I also had a squadron that I was a part of, and I had sailors that I was, leading, taking care of. And I think at the end of the day, when you think about it, and you're like, okay, if it comes down to, if I don't go out and do this job and kill somebody, because they're threatening me or more, they're threatening my squadron mates and they're threatening the people and my squadron, all the sailors, then yes, I'm absolutely going to go do that because I don't want to lose those people. So it's tough. It's such a tough question. But I also feel like this is why I think a lot of veterans are well, I won't speak for all veterans, but I know as a veteran, and as someone who never saw combat, so I want to be really clear, like I never had to shoot anybody, I was never shot at. I think I'm very, very sensitive to how our military is deployed and what types of situations we're putting them in, because I think it really has to be worth it. I mean, like, is this worth the lives of our youth? And so I think we need to consider that when our government is making decisions about where we do deploy our troops and our sailors,
Right.
because it's a really I think it's a
It's a
difficult
tough
thing
one,
to
isn't
deal
it?
with.
And the
It
reason why
is.
I'm fascinated as well by it is, I've worked with officers, police officers who have been tactical firearms officers who, of course, are carrying firearms in the knowledge that they may have to use lethal force. And I ask you the question as well because your focus now, as you say, older, wiser, and a focus you have on the human being over the human doing, but you were in a role for 10 years where you may have had to take the life
Yes.
of a human being. So it's trying to reconcile those two and understand the journey that you've been on and you're still on from the days of being a combat fighter pilot to now to being, probably a mum and a wife and a daughter.
Yes.
And
Yeah.
yeah, do you see what I mean? That journey
Oh,
piece is
absolutely.
fascinating to me.
I can understand why, and especially with your experience, because I imagine that many of the people that you probably had encounters with were individuals, right? Individuals who were doing bad things, who needed to be stopped. And I think that's such an acute, like situation where it's you're drawn into being in a place where you have to make this decision, right? I think where I was actually, I mean, I don't know if lucky is the right way to describe it, but I think it was easier for me because someone else made that decision, right? I'm trusting that whoever made that decision that I would need to go execute is doing it for the good of our country, of, the people on this ship, the people in my squadron, all those things. And that I think made it a little bit easier for me to reconcile. I think it would be a lot harder if I were, if I were an infantryman or a marine on the ground having to, do it, having to kill someone directly. That to me, I think would have felt that would have been harder, I think,
Sure.
than, having
It's
that
more
distance that
personal,
I
isn't it?
had.
It's you know, the phrase up close and personal really does kind of fit into to what it is you're describing. From that decade of working with the US Navy, what has that done for you now in the work that you do with leaders and organizations? How does that play out in the work that you do?
Well, I try not to be too glib about it, but it's like, you know, at the end of the day, no one's dying here. So, you know, it brings perspective to the work that we're doing. And I think that that's helped in, you know, trusting that the decisions that we make are going to be good decisions, or even if in the future we think they're not good decisions, or we look back and we reflect and decide, oh, that maybe that wasn't the best decision. At the time, it was the best decision, or we thought it was the best decision. So I think probably perspective is the gift that came out of that Navy experience, of being able to hopefully stay more present and not get too worked up about the future and not have regrets about the past, but really just focus on this moment. And that's a good question.
Yeah, no, and also, because we're kind of riffing with it, but I think the word that I've also heard you say a number of times is trust. Now, there's an ultimate level of trust, because you're saying that somebody senior far, far away may have made a decision which allows you to use lethal force.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a level of trust.
Yes. And I mean, but the military operates on that. Like, we have to be able to trust our senior leaders that they're seeing things that we might not. But then also there's a level of trust that comes up from the ground as well, you know, from the people out front. Like, if we're seeing things on the ground and then, you know, in the squadrons, on the ships, and we're surfacing that to our leaders, they need to trust that, you know, we're sharing that in order to improve, our ability to do our missions. So yes, trust is really important.
I mean, you talked about having that desire to be of service, and I can imagine with the family, a military family that you came from, that was almost inbuilt in you. But he also talked about pushing the limits. Did doing that in some ways test you, push your limits to see exactly what you were able to do, what you were capable of?
Yes, and that has also been, I think that is part of who I am. I like to challenge myself. I like to see what I'm capable of, but also to recognize my limits and to determine, like, which things do I really want to push versus which things do I want to just accept? So I laugh because I really don't like running. It's probably another reason why I did not become a Marine.
Right.
But I did run a marathon when I was 30. And part of it was, okay, if I'm ever going to run a marathon, I should do it now before I get much older. And I had been running a lot during my second deployment. We have treadmills, you know, on the ship where you can run. And I felt like, okay, I might be able to do this. And so again, it was an opportunity to prove to myself that, okay, I'm not going to set any records running this marathon. In fact, I think I made it just under 6 hours. It was a long, you know, I'm a slow, slow runner, but I finished it. And that was what was most important to me. And so, yeah, I do feel like I choose things because it's not so much, again, the doing part of, I want to accomplish this thing. It's more, I want to prove to myself that I'm capable of the things that I need to do in order to get to that achievement. So I want to be able to challenge myself to get up, you know, however many days a week and go run in order to prepare for this goal, this doing thing.
Right.
I want to be a person who, can be, can do the, what do I want to say? I want to be a person who can challenge herself and not give up. And so when I do things like that, that I think that's part of how I am experiencing life, and, you know, doing these things and focusing how I'm being in these, that's what to me is creating a fulfilling life
for
me. You know, it might not be for everybody, but
we're all personal, aren't we? So I know you've written a couple of books, so you know there's a lot in you, and I always find that people write books, it needs to get out, doesn't it? So you've done that a couple of times. But I'm intrigued as well, because you did a one-woman show just off Broadway, didn't you? Come on, you've got to tell us about that. What's that about?
Yeah. So the one-woman show was, it was funny because it's actually, that has also evolved. The first version of the show I did was a recognition of my own personal growth. I think that's how I would classify it, even though, yes, I had, you know, I talked about deploying and being in the Navy and flying in the Navy. A lot of the show was about my own personal development and, you know, growing up in a very conservative family, and then, you know, doing a lot of things that my family wanted me to do. And then, you know, going through a divorce, getting, you know, basically becoming an adult. And so I felt like that first show was more of a an inner journey that I shared with an audience. And so that was a show that I premiered off Broadway and then also performed it at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in 2022. And then, you know, after Edinburgh, after having done it like 23 days in a row, I definitely, A, was tired of doing it. And B, I just recognized that it wasn't really the show I wanted to do anymore. I really wanted to focus on that first deployment with women on board, which is what the topic of my first book is. She's Just Another Navy Pilot.
Right.
It's an aviator's sea journal. I kept a journal during that deployment, and the book is based off of that. So I went back to the, you know, back to the writing board and rewrote a lot of it, probably 75% of it, and made it more about my journey as a naval aviator, and especially as a woman being on that first deployment. And I really enjoyed that version of the show. I performed that at the Hollywood Fringe Festival last year, and then also off Broadway again at the United Solo Festival.
Right.
And it really was a way for me to express myself in a different way. I did theater in high school. I did some community theater when I was in the Navy. I always really enjoyed being up on a stage. I think that's why it's been easier for me to gravitate more towards doing keynote speaking, because I really like storytelling and sharing my story with audiences in hopes that it will inspire them. Because I found so many speakers and books that I've read have inspired me in different ways. And so you just never know what little nugget is going to resonate with somebody and hopefully put them on a path towards fulfillment.
Well, so, I mean, I've met lots of speakers and authors, Laurie, but you're the first person who said you just felt as if you needed to write something and then actually do it off Broadway and at the Fringe Festival. Because I got to tell you, that's quite a scary prospect. I have been to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival a couple of times. That's not for the faint-hearted. Why on earth would you decide to do that?
Oh, good question. I just felt like it would be really fun to be in this community of other performers and other storytellers. And I'd never been to Edinburgh. So I thought, well, I'm sorry, I had visited Edinburgh once just for a few days and I loved it. And I thought, wow, to be able to live in Edinburgh for a month and do this show. And, you know, my show is an hour long. So I figured, well, you know, that's an hour a day I have to be at the theater to do my show. And then the rest of the time I could be out and about exploring Scotland. But the reality was that, you know, there's the prep before the show, there's the, you know, wrapping things up after the show. There's taking care of yourself, taking care of your health. You know, it's not like I could be out late at night. You know, I had to protect my voice. So, but it still was fantastic. I absolutely loved living there for the month and meeting the other performers and seeing so many shows. It was really, really, I mean, part of it was not just, I want to bring my show to Edinburgh. It was also, I want to be able to be in this environment and see so many amazing performers and hear their stories too. So, so it was definitely selfish.
Well, it's another hell of an experience, isn't it? I think I'm definitely seeing the clues. Laurie, what's next for you?
So what's next is, well, at least for the next year, I'm going to be a fellow for Harvard's Advanced Leadership Initiative.
Yeah.
And this is a cohort-based program of about 40 to 50 leaders who go through a year at Harvard. And we take classes, we learn about various, you know, societal issues such as, you know, climate change, food inequity, lots of different ways that we could potentially help serve society and, you know, either maybe start a company or join a nonprofit or do something that can have positive societal impact. So that's what I'll be doing for the next year. And I'm really excited to be back on a college campus. I used to live right by Stanford University, and it was always so much fun to be there. I actually worked at Stanford for a year and a half.
Oh, did you?
And yeah, so I'm excited to
Well, I visited both, so I feel myself lucky. I visited both Stanford and also Harvard. So I'll be in Boston later in the year. But what's behind that decision now to become a student for a year at Harvard, living and staying in, hence you're going to Boston. What's going on, Laurie? What's driving that?
A couple of things. First, I really want to stay on the East Coast to be closer to my parents as they're getting older. And also my brothers are in Alexandria, Virginia, and my daughter is going to school in New York City. So my son is in Arizona, but pretty much the center of gravity for my family has shifted to the East Coast.
Right.
So I wanted to stay on the East Coast. I am still not really sure what I want to do next. I do have this feeling I really would like to get back to a leadership role with a team in some form. So I don't know what that looks like. I've worked with startups. I've worked with larger companies. I've, you know, been on the board of a nonprofit. So I'm
exploring.
I want to figure that out. I'm exploring. That's a great way to put it. So this next year is a year of exploration for me to see what else is out there and let my intuition guide me as to what I should do next.
So Laurie, let me ask you this final question. What's the best piece of leadership advice that you've ever given or received? It's a good one, isn't it?
It is because there's so much good advice out there.
It's kind of whatever is front of mind for you.
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing that comes up for me a lot is the phrase, "This too shall pass."
Right.
And people typically only, you know, break that one out when someone's going through a crisis to remind you that, like, hey, it's not going to be horrible forever. You're going to get through this, which I think is good and helpful. But I think it's also helpful when we're talking about, you know, awesome things, like when you have a huge accomplishment. It's like, this too is going to pass, so appreciate it, right? And definitely celebrate achievements and be grateful for them and recognize them, but also recognize, like, we're not always going to be hitting things, you know, at the top, and it's not always going to go the way that we want it to. So when it does, appreciate it, but also recognize that it's not going to be like that forever. And I think the reason I like that advice as a leader is that it's, you know, it's a roller coaster. Being a leader is never always easy or always difficult. There's always the peaks and valleys. So how can we make sure that we're really more focused on the being of being with our teams and how we're showing up than on the achievements or on, you know, what people would call failures? But I like to take the judgment out of that and call it more, you know, the times when things don't work out the way that we want them to. So, because many times failures, or what we perceive as failures, actually turn out to be gifts, you know, if you just give it enough time. But yeah, so I would say this too shall pass, and
good advice.
Reminding people that, you know, you just don't know what's ahead.
No, this is so true. How do people get in contact with you, Laurie, if they want to continue the conversation or get you involved in their conversation?
Fantastic. Thank you. I am on all of the socials. So I'm on Instagram as Laurie Droughty, LoreeDraude.
Not as rowdy.
No.
Just asking.
I should have grabbed that one. And then also, I'm also on Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn. And then my website is super simple, LaurieDraughty.com.
I'll put that all in the show notes as well, Laurie. So
thanks, Adam.
That it's easy for people to find and people to click on. Listen, thank you so much for being a superstar, having this conversation. I know it's always brief, but it's wonderful to meet you, to chat to you, and we will stay connected. Who knows? Maybe we'll bump into each other in glorious Boston. Thank you so much for joining the Leadership Enigma.
Thank you for having me today, Adam.
Thank you, Laurie. Take great care now. Bye.